Good evening, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm so glad you're with me tonight. I have a very fascinating guest. New York Times bestselling author William Lashner joins me tonight. I don't know what you know about Mr. Lashner, but let me tell you, he is a bestselling author and the creator of Victor Carl, who's been called one of mystery novels' most compelling and morally ambiguous characters. That in itself fascinates me because you guys know I love to read mysteries and thrillers with really interesting characters. His work's been translated into more than a dozen languages, foreign languages, sold across the globe. His other books are called Bagman, Killer's Kiss, Fall, The Shadow, Fatal Flaw, Hostile Witness, Guaranteed Heroes, The Barkeep, which was huge. That was an Edgar Award nominee, and the Digital Book World number one bestseller, The Accounting, Blood and Bone. We are going to talk about his new book today, which is out now, called The Four-Night Run. It is my pleasure to welcome to Authors on the Air, Mr. William Lashner. Bill, how are you today? Thank you
great,
for being
Pam.
Here.
It's great to be here.
Thanks. It's so good that you're here. So listen, I'm fascinated, first of all, by your cover. I love the cover of this book, The Four-Night Run, with the dice on it, and the colors are great, too. I'm a huge fan of really good art on book covers. But I love the beginning of this book. Will you tell us a little bit about it, please? This is The Four-Night Run.
Yeah, this is a lawyer on the run story, but it takes place in a very strange city. It's very similar to Atlantic City, but not quite Atlantic City. And it starts with a mob. It starts with a mob trial, and then things just go haywire from there. And our hero ends up running. But I will tell you,
I love that.
The key of this is this is sort of my version of A Christmas Carol by Dickens. So we have a a defense lawyer who is on the run. He doesn't know why anybody's after him. And he, in effect, has to examine his own past, his own present, and his own future to figure it out. And as he does that, he starts getting a look at his own life, and he's not quite happy what he sees.
Tell me the name of your hero.
In this, it's J.D. Skribicek.
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 Uh-huh.
Nice Spanish name.
Yeah,
there's only like one or two vowels in the whole thing.
Right. So very good. I used to have only one or two vowels in our name before my dad shortened it, so I can understand that. Is he a new character for you?
Yes, he's a new. I've been writing standalones lately, and this is a standalone, and I find the freedom of it kind of very liberating. So that's what I've been pursuing.
I like that. So tell me what the difference is. You just said you like the freedom. It's liberating to write a standalone. What is the good part of writing a serious character, though?
Well, the best – when I wrote my Victor Carl series, the best part of it was that the voice was very much a part of me. And when I was ready to start it, I would just kind of shake my head a little bit, and Victor's voice would start coming out. I wrote that in first person. And it was, I loved the voice, and I loved the stories. And so it was always a very comfortable way to start a mystery.
Interesting.
But here's the thing that I found is I tried to make each book like a chapter in Victor's attempt to figure out who he is. And in effect, every detective has a code that they go by. And Victor, the Victor books are his attempt to figure out what his code is. And he always thinks he could step over this line or that line, and then when push comes to shove, he realizes he can't. And so pretty much he's defining himself through these adventures. And I've gotten to the point where he's pretty much just defined. And at that point, I decided to start writing standalones.
Victor's stories are very much noir. In the old sense of the word, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, he kind of is a character that is his own worst enemy. Even though he's the good guy and the bad guy kind of wrapped up into one. He's a paradox of a man, isn't he?
Yeah, Victor is the guy who always wants to kind of take the easy, dirty way out, and he finds that he's unable to. Something stops him. And I think it's the great disappointment in his life is that he's not able to do everything he could to be the success that he wants to be. But there are lines he won't cross.
Well, there you go. And isn't that the classic noir character? Are you a fan of the Noir at the Bar series?
I love noir. In Philadelphia, every other year we have what's called NoirCon, which I've been going to for years and years. And I love the whole idea of it. I love the darkness, the existential aspect of it, which I think is implicit in it. And the books that I read that I wanted to write like were Red Harvest by Dashiell Hammett and Farewell My Lovely. These old noir novels were the ones that were the kind of books that I wanted to write. It's funny, it was the existential books that made me want to become a writer, but it's the noir books that I decided I wanted to write.
It's interesting to me. I was very not aware of the newer noir writers. I was unaware of that group of people until after BoucherCon last year. And I was so fascinated by the authors and their stories and about the flash fiction throwdowns they were doing, by the noir at the bar stories that I would hear and listen to, that as we created a noir on the radio show. And now we have a Dames in the Dark program and a Menacing Men at Midnight, and we have interviews. There is a rotating set of hosts, but one overall host, Greg Barth, who writes the Selena series, is absolutely fabulous. And we have another kind of noir show, Skid Row Chatter, with Tom Pitts, who is a fabulous author. He's really, really good. Interesting stuff. So I like noir, too. I like just what you're talking about. Older noir is what I'm used to. I'm not used to the neo-noirs, but I love it just as much. It's a fascinating, fascinating way to write.
And I will say this about the noir at the bar stuff. It took me a while to realize how to do it. Now I love doing it, but it's very competitive. I mean, you really got to go in there, and you you just can't read like four pages. You have to really kind of get something that grabs them and holds them, and it's actually good. It's a good practice for writing anything.
Well, and you know, this is what I find fascinating when you're going to do a piece of flash, let's say 800 to 1,000 words, Bill, you really have to be able to tell a story. Or a scene from a story that's so strong and catches, grabs you by the throat and won't let you go with a minimum of words to get the point across.
Right, and you better put a twist in there too. And
it's
very challenging, but when it's good and you can see that the audience kind of just jerks back, it's kind of very exciting.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. There are so many terrific noir writers out there right now. I'm looking at my bookcase in front of me and, you know, one full shelf all the way across is all the noir writers, and I love them very much, and I'm trying to absorb as much as I can. You have a very interesting – go right ahead.
No, I was going to say that in my standalones, I go outside that genre a lot. The Four-Night Run is very noir. It takes place in the bad part of this resort town. Underground. Most of the characters are underground type characters. It's all in shadow. He's running through the night. It's not running during. Nothing's happening during the days. It's like the definition of noir. But I also write Guaranteed Heroes is almost like a hippie adventure, dystopian adventure. It's, everything's different. I'm trying to write different stuff.
Do you enjoy that, challenging yourself like that, or do you
totally.
Feel compelled to write all this? That you feel compelled to try all these different subgenres, do you?
Yeah, you know, I that's one of the advantages of writing a standalone is that you can genre shift. You can, whatever works for the story you want to tell, whatever works best, that's the way you write it. That's the way I write it. And it all sounds like me because I can't write like other people, but you know, I can it's different. I can elevate the tone when I need to. I can write, you know, it can be funny. I always try to put humor in everything because I think I always think humor is serious business, and it really elevates.
It really is. I think you're right. If it's the right kind of humor for this style, I absolutely agree with you. And the ironic humor is really interesting in books. One of your most popular books is The Barkeep. Tell me why.
You know, The Barkeep is it's got two things going on, which I think is attractive. One, there's a lot of Zen stuff in it. One of the bases for the book is a Tibetan Book of the Dead, which actually my dad had that in his bedroom. I remember my dad had that book. This is a while ago, when Timothy Leary and the Baba mm-hmm. Ram Dass were running around, and they wrote a version of it. So there's mm-hmm. that. There's a lot of Zen in it. What I call it a novel of Zen Spence, because the hero is trying to kind of Zen out his life. But there's also a father-son story at the center of the book. A father who's accused of murdering the mother, and the son is trying to figure out, did his dad do it? Or, you know, and how he's still trying to figure out how to relate to his father. And I think there that exists. That never stops, trying to figure that out, how to relate to your dad. And that's an extreme example of it, because the father's in jail for murdering the mother. But still, it's like there is something about the relationship they have that I think resonates.
Interesting. It's a good theme too, you know, the dynamic between parent and child and how it plays out later on in life. So, you know, good for you. You found the sweet spot on that one for sure. I want to ask you about Blood and Bone, because we're talking again about a son and a father. So let's talk about that one, because it's interesting to me.
Yeah, that was definitely another father-son. I think I have to say my dad died, and a while ago. But I've been processing it in these books, which is a very kind of interesting situation. I mean, when I first started writing about fathers and sons, it was about my father. But now that I'm a father and my sons are almost grown, it's like it's very interesting. I see both sides of it now in a way I didn't. But that's sort of a fantasy book. Because it's about a kid who loses his father and then kind of always sees him around, like a vision of him. And eventually he comes back and there's this relationship. And he goes through the relationship with his dad in the book that he never had as a kid. And he does it in like 4 days. And he goes through everything, the rebellion, the acceptance, the giving over, and then becoming his own individual in the course of the time of the book, which is normally goes through, it's a 20-year process.
Wow. Wow. I can't wait to read that one. I like the praise that the book was given. American Chronicle said it had my full attention right from the very first page. It is a standalone novel that will keep the reader in suspense while turning the pages. I like that kind of book. I really do. That fascinates me.
And it's also, I have to say, it's a fantasy, because everyone who loses a father just would love to have them back just for a few days.
Oh.
To deal with something.
Listen, both my parents are gone right now.
There's always something left undealt with.
Of course,
and that right, and then that character, in a way, that was based a little bit on Louis Kahn, the architect, who had like three different families and kids from all these different families, and wasn't really involved in the families much. And it's sort of like his son made a film about him. I said, boy, that's really interesting. So that was sort of a model.
Wow. That is interesting. You seem to grab a lot of themes from family, and you grab a lot of themes from things that are in the air around you. Is that what happens?
Yeah. Yes. Family, definitely. I mean, everything comes from that. But I also, I pretty much, I'll steal from anything, just to get the idea, the beginning of something, and then I change it because
it
all. Stories. The stories are around us everywhere. There was a cocaine ring in Philadelphia. This is a while ago. Mm-hmm. That was run by a dentist. He was started as a Penn Law student, a Penn Dental student, and all the dental students were involved in this coke ring. It was the biggest coke ring on the East Coast. And the story was so fascinating that I wrote a book about that. It's called Past Due. But that was just, I changed everything. And because my guy's a lawyer, it was lawyers instead of dentists. But it was the after effect, the aftermath of that, what happens when they all get, it all gets blown up, which it did. So, yeah, I take that, and that's my starting point. And then I create something completely different. I just create something new. And it's, I'm not telling that story. I'm just using that as a starting point to create a story
sure.
that I want to.
You enjoy the writing process quite a bit, don't you, Bill?
I love it. It's the truest expression of my soul. There it is. It might not, when you read it, you might be reading, you know, you're reading a mystery and you judge it by that. But for me, it's like I'm expressing everything in me, one way or the other.
I love that. I love to hear that. Will you tell listeners about what you used to do, please? What your former profession was before you were writing.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was an attorney.
But not just an attorney.
No, I worked for the Department of Justice as a prosecutor. And then I left that to work with my dad. My dad got sick, and I left the Department of Justice, which is really, I have to say, was the best job I ever had, prosecuting. There was something about it where you're pursuing justice, which is what authors do. Joyce Carol Oates calls a novel a justice-dealing machine, and that's sort of what I felt like as a prosecutor. That was my job. But then my dad got sick, and he had a law office, and I went and worked with him and kept it going with him.
You were a criminal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., and when you went with your dad, what kind of law practice did he have?
He did bankruptcy, and I was his litigator. So whenever he had to try something, I would try the case. And then in the middle of that, I left to go to writing school for a couple of years. And
where did you go to writing school?
The University of Iowa.
Tell me about your experience going back to school to go to writing school. I want to hear about this.
Well, that was great. That's a great question. There are two types of people who went to Iowa. They were the people right out of college. And then there were people who had a profession or a job and were doing it at a little older. I was already 30 when I went. And there is a difference. For me, I was a little desperate. I knew what would happen if the writing didn't work. I knew what I'd be doing the rest of my life, which is lawyering. And I wanted to write. And I think the younger ones who went there, it's a different experience. It's sort of like, their friends are in law school, their friends are in med school, they're in writing school, it plays out differently, I think.
Where did your passion for writing come from? It had to come from reading, and you had to have started reading at a very young age, am I correct?
Yes, I mean, I was reading adult books very young.
Who was the reader which of your parents, or were both parents?
My mother was an English teacher. My mother was an English teacher, and she was...
Uh-huh.
She had a great collection of books, and I was reading. We had a series then called The Great Books. I don't know if they still do. And I was reading I was going through The Great Books when I was in elementary school. And I remember I went through the entire Sherlock Holmes in like fifth grade and The Count of Monte Cristo. And I was reading. I was reading everything I could get my hands on. That was big and boyish and adventurous. And then I found comic books. And I have to tell you, I pretty much gave up those big books for comic books for a long time because I loved comic books. I still love comic books. And actually,
they're very, very popular. Popular right now.
Their mode, it's not just that. The mode of storytelling is different, and I found it exciting. And I have to say that the four-night run is, in my head, it's like a great graphic novel in a way. It's like that. It's as influenced by Watchmen by Alan Moore as it is by Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett.
Interesting. I wonder, why did you decide to go to law school and not try writing right away?
That's a good question. This is after college, after I graduated. People were applying to law school, and I actually applied because my dad was a lawyer. And then I decided, I read On the Road. My senior year, I read On the Road by Kerouac, and I said, well, I'm not going to go to law school. You read that,
you don't want to go to law school after that.
No.
Right.
So I went on the road. I traveled. And apparently people don't do this now. But I went for a year. I just put a backpack. I worked all summer to get the money, and then I went through the world for a year.
Tell me where you went. Tell me about your adventure.
Well, mostly Europe and the Mideast.
What did you find when you were traveling? Were you traveling by yourself?
I traveled some with myself, and a friend joined me, and we traveled together.
When you finished traveling, what did you find out?
Well, after a while, I took like 6 months in Jerusalem. After I was traveling around, I lived in Jerusalem 6 months, and my brother actually was there. And I lived with him, and I tried to write. There was a great English bookstore in Jerusalem, and I would buy the used paperbacks, and I'd read everything. And I was trying to write, and I got to tell you, I was writing badly. I knew it. I was writing this fake Kerouac stuff because I still was intoxicated with On the Road. And I hadn't found my voice, and it just wasn't that good. And at that point, going back to America, I'd been accepted to law school, and I told them I wasn't going. And NYU was kind enough to say, well, we'll wait for you. And so I just showed up there. And I have to say, I loved law school. Loved it.
I
love graduate school. I love Iowa too.
It's law school is very confidence building, isn't it? One of my brothers went to law school, and I think that he would be the person he is today. And he's a litigator also, but in corporate litigation. So I think that gave him a lot of confidence in himself, and so he could do anything he wanted to do. Did you find that you got that as well?
Well, yes. I mean, I really liked it because it's a very intellectual exercise. You're using words.
Right.
It's not science. You're using words and ideas and applying them to facts. And it fit my head. And I have to tell you, it's very similar to what I do as a writer. When I was clerking for a federal judge, I would write all the fact patterns. I was feeling like I was writing a novel.
Interesting.
So, and he had a rule. He didn't like adjectives or adverbs as the judge. And so I would write everything without adjectives or adverbs. You had to get the right verb. And I would try to make it as exciting as possible with just rhythm and getting the right word and having no descriptive stuff going on. And it was actually
So it was just the facts, right? It was just the facts, ma'am, and that was it.
Yeah, but how you frame it, the rhythm that you build, it was like a master class in learning how to write before every opinion I wrote, and we were churning them out. The fact pattern, I would spend time on the fact pattern.
So let me ask you this: being the voracious reader that you were as a youngster, and of course you kept up all your reading, and obviously Kerouac motivated you to travel, which I think is a very good thing. And then you read more and you wrote more when you were clerking for a federal judge, which is a very prestigious position, I know, and very difficult to get. Do you think that being that reader as a youngster put you light years ahead of those who were not readers as youngsters and didn't continue to read?
I think the continuing to read thing is more important than when you start. I think continuing. I'm always looking for books. I'm always reading something, and I'm very conscious of not reading just one type of book. I read mysteries, of course, and thrillers, of course, but I also read a lot of literary stuff. I read romance. I'll read horror. I'll read anything. And I get, I find, I learn about my reaction. I will tell you, here's something that's interesting. So I was reading a romance book, and it was good. It was okay. And I'm reading it, and I get to the end, I'm bawling like a baby. I'm crying in a way that I don't cry about any other book. I'm just, she got me crying. And I'm thinking, and I hear, but here's the thing. The book was okay, but the book wasn't great. And I'm realized, but I'm tears are falling, and I'm realizing, you know but what? I'm realizing
that evoking the emotion.
Yeah, but it almost seems like it's easy. It almost seemed to me like, well, this is almost too easy. I've been very conscious of building up emotions, and lately I've been trying to pull back on that. I'm not trying to pull out every emotion I can get. Trying to create a different type of experience. And I don't mean that in a negative. I think the books are stronger because I'm not yanking at emotions at the here and there.
Well, you don't want to manipulate emotions, I
it
think,
becomes
right?
Very
you
easy.
Want them. Yes, yes.
Right. And I wrote Guaranteed Heroes, and I really believe that's my hippie book. And I really believe that I was being very dispassionate as possible. And then I was talking to my editor, and she said, "Oh, you had me crying." And I was upset. And I said, "Where were you crying? I messed up. What parts were you crying?" And he goes, "Well, when Digger died." And I go, "Yeah, well, yeah, that was sad. And that was okay."
But you know something? That's a good thing. I want to tell you that I speak to romance authors all the time as well, because I'm like you. I read cross-genre, except I don't read horror because it scares the devil out of me. I'm a wuss when it comes to horror. But I do like, I love fantasy, I love paranormal, I like urban punk, I like steampunk, I like, you know, any kind of romance there is, except for historical. It's like, I don't like anything historical. I love mysteries and thrillers and all that, and I love the noir genre. But romance is not easy to write when it's done well. It's easy to write it schlocky. But it's not easy to do well-written romance. And there are some very fine romance writers out there. And they struggle, I bet you, every bit as much as any other writer. It's just that it's a very different kind of dynamic, you know, when you're reading their books. I have two authors that I have fallen in love with this past year who write so different than any other writers I've ever read in the romance genre. And I don't think it's a manipulation of emotion so much as that is the natural response to feel happy or sad. Whereas in mysteries, like my heart beats and I feel on edge and my stomach gets in a knot. So it's a different type of an emotional pull. And
right.
It seems to me, Bill, that don't you want your reader to have some type of an emotional investment in what it is you're writing? Regardless of the genre.
Yeah, well, you definitely want the emotional investment. But you don't, but
right.
I purposely try not to manipulate them or to pull out tears anymore. Or you can do it. My language, I've been able to do that, but I've been pulling back from that a little bit. But not hope, and hopefully to get something deeper. Because the books that I love, I didn't cry during them. When I read All the King's Men, which is one of my favorite books, it stirs me deeply, but it doesn't bring. Not crying and I'm not getting maudlin. But I'm with the narrator. I'm with like Jack Burton every minute that he's going through.
It's not the only emotion you have to have is crying when you're reading a book.
Right.
I walk away. I've read a really good book, and that's when I know it's really good, is when days and weeks later I'm still thinking about the story, and months later I'm thinking about the story. Those are the ones that are going on my best of list, you know,
right.
When I keep thinking about that story over and over, and something in my day-to-day life will remind me of something in the story. To me, that's the mark of a good book, and it so happens that it could happen in romance, but not because it's a tearjerker or something, not because of that, but because something in the story impacts me. It just happens to impact me in a different way than, say, if I'm reading Guaranteed Heroes, something will impact me in that story in a different way. So, you know, I think that's really good, and I'm glad that to hear that you're not trying to manipulate it, because sometimes I think there, I have tried reading some books where I can feel the author trying to force an emotion from me, and I get upset by that, because readers, by and large, are pretty smart people anyway. People who read books, you know, they're pretty savvy people, and I want to be invested in your story. I want to make it a, you know, start my movie in my head. Does that make sense to you?
No, absolutely.
You know, when I say that, that
as a writer, you're always aware. You're always trying to get them hooked early on, and that's part of it.
Yeah.
But that's not manipulative. That's just giving.
No.
You know, that's just basic storytelling.
That's writing a good darn book. That's right.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
I don't want. Yeah, I don't want someone to tell me everything or not tell me enough. I think readers want to fill in bits and pieces of your story with some of their own ideas. Maybe it's about what a scene looks like, what a character looks like, what they're wearing, how their voice sounds, or something like that. It makes it a more interesting read that way. And I think it pulls readers into the story more. So sometimes less is more. Don't you agree?
Oh, I absolutely. And my descriptions have become, my character descriptions have become terser. I mean, I try to get. I want you to see them by reading the way they speak, and the way they act. I don't describe that their buttons or their cuffs or their stuff. But if you get them very quickly by their language. The jokes,
yes.
Their humor, or
I
lack
like
of
that.
It. That's where you get. And so, So the descriptions are not as I don't spend a page and a half describing my characters. I don't. I do them with a gesture and the dialogue.
Oh good. Oh good. I love that. So. I know you were saying that you're inspired by everything that happens in life, maybe a story, anything like that. So when you have all these things that are floating around in your head, and you say, I got to keep that in my mind. That's a really good, you know, I have an idea of that way. Or like, you know, the dentist who was the cocaine distributor and so on and so forth. When you're sitting down to write again, Bill, how do you pluck one story out? Which, does it sing to you louder than the others? Is it, or do you roll them all over in your head and think, let's see, what if? And how does it happen for you that you make a choice of that particular thought process?
Well, I have a notebook of ideas. So I'm always putting down different ideas in the book, and I'm working them out. When you have a story, you need to be able to see it. Now, when you're writing it, it changes, and it should change.
Right.
If it doesn't change while I'm writing it, I feel like it's not working. But
okay.
I don't start writing until I see the whole thing. And sometimes, like I have a great story that I'm just dying to write, but I can't figure out the bad guy in the story. It's a thrillerish thing, and I have the good guy, and I have the person he relies on, and I have the community, but I don't have the bad guy. And until I have the bad guy, I can't write it. So
no, obviously.
That's one of my stories that are in my notebook, and I just want to write it. And then what I do is when I think I've got something, I start outlining it, creating a map of it, just so I have a sense. I want to have a sense of where it's going to go at the end and what its structure is. And then as I'm writing, I'm always changing that outline. Things are always popping into my head, and one thing that pops in your head early can change everything in the end. But that's okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Then you go and I re-outline it as I'm writing, and then when I finish the whole thing, and I'm a big believer in finishing. It's the most important thing as a writer is to finish what you start.
Sure.
Then I re-outline the thing again, and I see where the weaknesses are, because like I say, something should happen here and it's not. Figure out something, and then I outline it again, and then I rewrite it based on that new outline.
It's very interesting. I have never heard of anyone who outlines more than once. Let me ask you a question. Who is your first reader?
You know, I used to send it to people, and now I don't show it to anybody until it's done. By that I mean
re-edit it and re-edit it until you're satisfied with it.
By that I mean the first person who sees it, of course, is my editor, and
I'm
a believer
or something like that.
No,
okay.
I don't show them. I'm a believer that you don't send something to your editor with the hope that she'll save it for you, or that she'll tell you how to fix it. You want to wow your editor the first time she reads or he reads it, and so I try to make it as good as I can. And of course, she always has ideas and way to make it better, which is great. But I don't send it. I don't want anyone to see it until it's as solid as I can make it. And I think as soon as people see it, it changes. That's just the way it works.
It does. Hold on just one second. I want to give listeners the number. If you want to talk to William Lashner, New York Times bestselling author, about any of his books, and I have an interesting little story to tell you about him too, please give us a call at 347-633-9609. That's 347-633-9609. So I'm going to skip around just for a minute here, because just briefly before the show started, we talked about author Tyler Knox, who is also your alter person, your other personality. You wrote a book called Cockroach, spelled K-O-C-K-R-O-A-C-H. Tell me why the name change and why this book? And let's talk a little bit about it.
Well, I told you, the books that made me want to become a writer were the existential books I was reading in high school, stuff like The Stranger by Camus and The Plague by Camus and a book called Nausea by Sartre, The Trial by Kafka, and The Metamorphosis by Kafka. And these are books that still, when I think about them, I get choked up. They're just so amazing. So I wanted to write like that. So in the midst of my thriller career, I decided to write my existential book. And I started with the beginning of The Metamorphosis, where a man wakes up and he turned into like a dung beetle. I think that's the term that Kafka uses in the German.
Mm-hmm.
So I started as a cockroach, which is what I wanted to use, who wakes up as a man. That was in the first sentence. And then I spent the rest of the book, his rise through New York and the American society. And it's called Cockroach. And it was so much fun to write. It's also very noir. It takes place in 1950 Manhattan, a lot of it in the Times Square of the era, which is very different than the Times Square now.
Sure.
And I thought it was very funny. It had a lot of great characters, and the reviews were smashing. It was a New York Times editor's choice. It was really kind of very cool. But I didn't want to I didn't want to confuse my readers who were waiting for the next Victor Carl book, which is a basic legal thriller. So I used a different name for the existential. I thought I'd write a series of existential books with this name, and I could do both. And I haven't gotten around. I started others, but they haven't come together, other Tyler Knox books.
Interesting. It's fascinating. And both PW and Booklist gave you raving reviews on these. They were just so excited about this book. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I am going to take your advice. I am going to go and buy that book and read it. So I definitely will. And I'll email you back and tell you what my thought is on it, okay?
Thank you.
Well, you know, you've talked a lot about the existential books that have really guided a lot of what you do. Is there any book that you've read just for the sheer joy of reading it more than once, one that you feel like you've got to pull it down every year off your bookshelf and say, okay, it's time to read this one again?
Well, I have to say, I do read The Maltese Falcon over and over. There's something about that. For the longest time, I would not read On the Road Again, because it was the most seismic event in my life, maybe, reading that, and I didn't want to be disappointed. But lately, I just read it a couple of years ago, and I still think it's amazing. So it held up for me.
It isn't. It is an amazing book. True. Makes you want to think about maybe you want to run away for a year, you know, kind of stop everything for a year and you just go and then come back, blink it back into existence, you know? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then I'm a big fan of Irwin Shaw. And so every once in a while I'll reread Young Lions. I'll do The Dubliners by James Joyce, especially, which is a short story collection, especially The Dead, which is one of my favorite things, which I reread. And then I like Hemingway. So, it sounds a little eclectic, but I'll reread those short stories a lot. Hills Like White Elephants I read constantly.
I like that. I have just a few in my hand and just found another one that will go into my collection. I don't know if you're familiar with Naomi Novik's Uprooted. It is a fantasy book, but it sticks with me every single day, and I've read it a while ago. I will always keep that one. It's sitting right in front of me, as a matter of fact. I'm looking at it right now because the book is just so phenomenal. So I will always read that. But I have others, too, that I read. So I know what you're talking about. And since I'm constantly reading, sometimes I like to go back to the old familiar ones that wrap me in a lot of good feelings, and because I know that I'm going to love the book again. I never get tired of reading it. So my literary taste runs to, like, Pat Conroy's Prince of Tides. So
right,
it's a little bit different than yours. Not quite so existentialist or esoteric as your books are, but I like that book an awful lot, and so much so that I actually read it out loud one time because I love how the words
sounded
together.
With my wife, we were driving cross country. She was pregnant at the time. We were driving west to east, and I listened to that whole book on tape, and it is an amazing thing to listen to that. It's the syrup of the words just flows through you. It's amazing.
Yes, it is truly. That's what it is. And I remember taking, I can't remember, it was an English lit class. I can't even remember. And we were going to write on that book. We had questions that we could answer. And I remember reading it again with such joy, thinking, oh, my God, what an amazing an amazing book. I had forgotten how beautiful written it was. And the sound of it, the sounds of, you know, the movie did not do it justice, but I will tell you, Nick Nolte's voice stays in my ear when I read it now because his voice was perfect for that character. In my mind of listening, I have never listened to an audiobook ever. I'm too afraid that my mind won't be as engaged in listening to an audiobook as I will be if I'm reading it.
I will tell you, Pam, I like listening to audiobooks. I find them, is different. It's hard to go, when you hear a sentence that's so wonderful, it's hard to go back and grab it. But it does flow through you in a different way. It's a definite, strong experience. It might be different,
really?
But it is a definitely rich experience.
I'm afraid that if I have it in an audiobook, say in my car, and I don't do that much driving, but if I do on a trip, I'm afraid I'll lose bits and pieces that my mind won't stay with what I'm listening to because, you know, driving, you have to be so aware. Even if I go from west to east in Florida, it's only 2 hours, you know?
Right.
So I can easily go from Fort Myers to Miami, where I was born, in no problem whatsoever. But it's only a 2-hour trip, and I'm afraid that my mind would wander either from the road or from the book. So that's why I've never done it before. But I understand that there's some great audio books out there that have these professional readers who are magnificent. So maybe I need to get one of yours on Audible and do that.
That might be
the ticket.
I will tell you that I was driving to Michigan to watch my daughter's graduation, and I had a copy of my audiobook. I was driving with my son, who had never read the book, a book called The Accounting, which is about a suburban dad, which is what I sort of am, with his kid and his relationship with his son. And my son was listening, and he loved it. It was actually a great experience driving out to Michigan for graduation with my son listening to every word. So that was kind of cool.
Have your kids read your books?
Different kids do different stuff. My son Jack has read Cockroach. I was sitting on the beach with him when he was reading Cockroach, and that was kind of cool. And he just finished Guaranteed Heroes. He went to Wesleyan, which is sort of a hippie school, so the book sort of fit him.
It's not a hippie school anymore, is it?
I spent a lot of time up there. It is definitely of a different stripe.
Really?
It's like it competes with Oberlin for the hippiest school, but I think Oberlin might win. But oh no. It's definitely up there.
Oh, that's funny. What's next on the agenda for you? Have you begun writing again already?
Yes. Well, I actually just finished another one, which is a very strange, cool book that I wrote, and I'm very excited about it. So we'll see.
Can we have a title? I will
tell you, Pam, that the one thing that changes more than the outlines in my books are the titles. I start with one title in my head, and that's what I go with when I'm writing it. But I'm very conscious that the title is going to change.
That's interesting.
I don't even worry about it at this point. It's just the title is basically for me to know which manuscript or which file it is.
You're writing on.
Will this be another standalone? Another standalone.
Will you go back to writing in your series, do you think?
I think I will eventually. When I have a strong sense of where Victor needs to move next. But I will tell you that I'm having a blast writing these standalones. They're all different, and the response I get is kind of interesting because people miss Victor. And they say, this isn't, he's not doing as good as Victor. And then other people are saying, this is, they're appreciating the fact that I'm pushing envelopes and trying to do something really cool.
There you
cool.
go.
And,
I think that's great that you're playing with all the different genres and the different styles and everything. You're doing a great job. People are loving it, obviously, when they follow you. It's sometimes hard to get people to follow other books besides the series character. So it's it has its upside and its downside. But I'm having fun with this book. I'm loving this book.
Well, that's great. Thank you. They jumped on the barkeep. They like the Zen stuff. They like that Tibetan Book of the Dead stuff. That always goes over. I might have to write some more Buddhist thrillers.
We're out of time tonight, but I have so enjoyed our conversation. I wish you would come back and visit with me again.
I would love to, Pam. This was great. I really enjoyed this.
I enjoyed it, too. Ladies and gentlemen, William Lashner, New York Times bestselling author. Go and check out his website. It's easy to use. No bells, no whistles. It's going to have just exactly what you need there. The books, a little bit about him. And don't forget to look at, we didn't even get to talk about Pulp Fiction, which is just terrific. Go and take a peek at it. And Bill, congratulations on all your success. I am going to buy Cockroach, and I'll be in touch with you about
my thoughts
on that, okay?
All right,
Have a really wonderful weekend, okay? Thank you so much.
All right, Pam, thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
And that's it for tonight, folks. I hope you have a lovely weekend. Go get yourself a book. It's beach reading weather. Even if you're not at the beach and you're inside of the air conditioning, give yourself a break. Read a good book. Have a lovely weekend. Thanks for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.